We can go on with the sermon now. Johnny Nash, 1965, I was a junior in high school when he came out with this particular song. And at the time, I had no idea that it was a reggae song. As a matter of fact, I didn't even realize that until I was kind of picking up and doing some study on it now. So you might think that I've got this thing about reggae, because last Sunday I did some Bob Marley, and this time. This was the first reggae song that was recorded outside of Jamaica by a non-Jamaican person. He's a UK individual. But I was talking to our neighbor out at the lake, Nancy Cook. Some of you may know her. And she was kind of laughing about this particular song and talking about when she was in school and this song came out. This was the song when she was doing her math homework. And she's going, what is that? And, you know, just that brick wall you run into. And her solution was to take this Johnny Nash song, I Can See Clearly Now. You know how you used to do when you were a teenager and you now do when your kids are not watching, and you crank the music up to full blast and you're kind of dancing around the room and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, whether it was trigonometry or geometry, I have no idea, but she could see clearly. Now, around here, we're hoping with the smoke that, you know, that the sun may, or that the smoke may clear, actually that the rain may come and clear things out so we can see clearly now. But I use this song as kind of a theme for today's service because really, you know, in reading that, there's some things in this, if you just do this flat reading of the gospel for today, we're talking cranky Jesus again. You know, and there's a couple cranky Jesus texts, and this is one of them. You know, I will follow you, but first let me go bury my father. Well, you know, of course, put in context, that probably meant that he was a 20-year-old. His father was 40. He needed to go take care of the farm for the next 25, 30 years until he received his inheritance, and then maybe he would, so within that context, it's all about taking care of things. But keeping things in context is an important thing to do. To understand Scripture, we have to understand that the Old Testament, written primarily in Hebrew, Hebrew is a three-consonant language. Most words are made up of three consonants, and they're read right to left. Semantic languages, Arabic and Hebrew, and there's some others that are read that way. But anyway, they're made up of three consonants. There weren't any vowels added until about 90 AD, so about 90 years after the birth of Christ is when they finally added the vowels to the Hebrew language. So when it talks about in the book of Revelation, you shall not add one jot or tittle to the text, what they're talking about is the vowels, because the jots and the tittles were the vowel symbols that were put underneath the consonants so other people could read them. Up until then, you didn't need consonants because people knew what it said, and nobody really, it was an illiterate society, and even in the time of Jesus and beyond, it was a largely illiterate society. And so the scriptures were primarily for the person presenting the scriptures as kind of a guideline to read it. And even in the New Testament, not so much with Paul because he was trained in classic Greek, but most of the Gospels and most of the other writings in the New Testament were written in a style in Greek where they needed to say, there wasn't such a thing, you couldn't go buy a ream of paper. It was written on sheepskin primarily, or papyrus, which is pounded reeds that are woven together and pounded into paper. And so that was scarce. And so in writing, in the Greek language, it was usually written all in capital letters with no punctuation between words or sentences, or, you know, it was like one long string of letters that went like that. Try that in English and see how well you do as far as reading it. You had to know what it said. And so it was presented because the scriptures are primarily an oral tradition. They were not studied and read. Oh, let's read this verse. Nobody read this verse. We do that now because we can all read and we think we're so smart to do so. But that's not how the scriptures were written. They were written to be sit back and heard. That's how it came to us. So with that, you get this broad view. And when you get this broad view, then you can put things in context. So that's what we're doing today, is trying to put things in context. Now, the first thing to look at is sort of like bookends in the Gospels. In the beginning of chapter 9, you have the story of Jesus sending out the 12 disciples. And he says, go to these towns, and when you get to these towns, bring the good news, and if they're not going to accept you, you kick the dirt off your sandals, and you leave. In other words, you know, you don't browbeat them, you give them an opportunity, and if they don't want to take it, move on, somebody else will do it, you know, it'll happen, it'll eventually get there, or at least maybe you planted a few seeds and don't worry about it. It's not about converting everybody. It's about bringing the good news that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And so when we have that particular, and the reason that that is important is because in the beginning of chapter 10, you have the story of Jesus sending out the 72, which may go, 72? Who are the 72? Keep in mind, there was the 12 disciples, but there were all the women who were also following Jesus, who were part of that whole group. There were lots of other people who were following Jesus. This was an important thing. So after sending the disciples out, then the next story we have in Luke is about feeding the 5,000. Oh, it's a wonderful story. We think of Jesus standing on the hillside and 5,000 people come, and Jesus takes a few bread and fish and blesses them, and all of a sudden there's this big pile of bread and fish, and they pass it all out and everybody eats. That's not how it happened. First of all, 5,000, this is a patriarchal society, so when they talk about 5,000, they're talking about 5,000 men who brought with them their wives and their children. So we're talking not 5,000, but probably closer to 20 or 30,000 who were gathered there. Five loaves and the five fishes, there's lots of different ways of interpreting it. The easy miracle for Jesus would have been, boom, zap, we have a whole great big pile of bread and fish, pass them out. That's the easy thing. I think Jesus took the hard route. I think Jesus took the hard route because he turns to his disciples when they said, this is all we got. And what did Jesus say to them? You feed them. Huh? This isn't Jesus doing it. This is the disciples doing it. You feed them. So this is my understanding of the miracle that took place there. The disciples started passing it around. And as they started passing it around, the people who were gathered go, well, this ain't going to make it. You know, I brought some granola bars. I'll throw those in there. Oh, I got, you know, some beef jerky. I got some jam that they gave me at church. I can put that in there, you know. And so I think the real miracle is not the multiplication of the physical multiplication of the loaves and fishes, but the breaking of the hardness of the hearts of the people who were gathered there so they could open up and share. And what is the end result? 12 baskets overflowing with enough food. 12, important in the Hebrew in Hebrew understanding in numerology, because 12 was the number of disciples, number of tribes. It indicated all. That's when they hear the word 12, that's what you're talking about. All, everybody. What was left over? Enough to feed everybody. The message, trust in people's hearts to share, and there's more than enough for everybody. And then we have the next thing. This is from Mark, but I couldn't find another text anyway, where Jesus is asking the disciples, who do people say that I am? And of course they hem and haw around until he finally goes, you, who do you say that I am? And Peter does a classic stand-up Peter where he goes, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus is proud, says, "Well done," and that's great. And then Peter, of course, immediately sticks his foot in his mouth and says, let's go ahead and skirt around this whole Jerusalem thing because they got crosses there and we don't want to go there. To which Jesus then responds, "The whole get behind me, Satan." But this, who is this Jesus? This is an important thing. Who is this Jesus that sends the people out with nothing? Which, have you ever thought of that? I wonder how Joel Osteen would preach that particular text. Go out with nothing. Now, it doesn't fit into the whole, if you love God, he'll give you a yacht thing, does it? Anyway, onward. Who does Jesus say I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Okay. They're getting it. This is part of their learning. Go out with nothing. Trust God. Feed them with nothing. Trust God. Who do you say that I am? I think you're the Christ, which is like you are God's presence in this world. All right. We're beginning to get it. And then if that isn't enough, we needed to go ahead and punctuate that a little bit because he takes Peter, James, and John up on a high mountain where he is transfigured before them, and the voice of God reaffirms, "This is my son, my beloved. Listen to him." Of course, they wanted to stay up there and build booths and have everybody come up the mountaintop and have a big worship experience up on the mountaintop. The mountaintop experiences, because then that's not anywhere near those crosses that Jesus was talking about, and that all sounded pretty good. And Jesus immediately, after this voice, "This is my son, my beloved, listen to him." I always get that there was more to that context than that. I'd like Peter was babbling. "Oh, it's good that you're here. We'll build three booths," and blah, blah. And the God says, "Peter, chill. Just be quiet for a minute and listen to him." That's kind of how I think God spoke. My particular take on that. Anyway, move on. Because Jesus didn't leave the disciples up there. Immediately afterwards, he took them down into the valley, down into the dirty streets where there were hurting people, and began to teach them that, no, you want to find God in this world. It is not the mountaintop experiences are wonderful gifts. That's dessert. Yeah, we all need a little dessert once in a while. Those mountaintop experiences. But really, it's down in the valley, down in the dirt streets of life. That's where you find God, in the least and the lost and the lonely. If you don't see God there, you're not really seeing God. Translation, as we look around this world and we look around what's happening, if you don't see God in the faces of kids that are taken away from their families and put in cages, you're not really seeing God.